Chapter 23, May 2057. A month after Mel returned from the moon, she and Tash got an invite from Wu Shi to California, where Serena Jones was going public with her Project Breakout scheme. So they hastily flew across the Atlantic, and then on across the continent. They ran late. Such a journey couldn't be taken for granted anymore. More transatlantic flights had been cancelled altogether because of the aftermath of the Hypergain. And now the biggest new problem was a kind of low-grade solar storm. The Earth's iron core was sloshing, another after-effect of the great jolt of the blink, still working its way through Earth's huge mass, its ponderous systems. As a result, the planet's magnetic field, produced by that disturbed core, was weakening, and so failing to shield the world from the energies of a still turbulent sun. Itself another blink aftermath. So winds of high-energy particles from space battered an orbital infrastructure of habitats and satellites, and in places reached down to the Earth's surface, causing comms disruptions and power outages. Current surges had melted cables, even. It was possible, some said, that the Earth's magnetic field could collapse altogether, or the poles could flip, north changing places with south. That had happened 42,000 years back. The Le Champ excursion, which appeared to coincide with the extinction of the Neanderthals, a branch of humanity, and so on. Tash knew that the experts called these phenomena, the Atlantic Hypercane, the solar storm, global geophysical events, like Krakatoa in 1883, the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004, events which transcended the customary human scale, and which had global effects, physically, economically. And ministers like Fred Bowles had been warned, the aftermath of the blink was bound to feature many more such events. And so, after limping across the ocean, the plane had flown low over North America, with whole communities gone dark, roads clogged with stationary vehicles, trains stranded on their tracks. They went through papers and other material in their different specialities through the whole flight. Their buddy Shi had invited them over, but they were here to work. Mel continued to be a trusted set of eyes and ears for Charlie Marlowe, as she had been from Blink Day, and the Astronomer Royal remained a go-to source for public comments on new developments, and a focus for the continuing astronomical and theoretical study of Galaxius and all its works. And Tash was here to report back on Jones's pitch to Fred Bowles, of course. Since Lee Yamanaka had extracted support for the Jones Inc. space project from a somewhat distracted President Cox, Jones and her associates had mostly kept quiet about their plans until this big reveal. Fred Bowles insisted he had to know what this was all about before committing any funding from a cash-strapped post-Blink England, as was suspected of China too. Tash knew that the endless diplomatic dance or power plays went on. You might have thought that the evident intrusion of the overwhelmingly powerful Galaxius would, as some SETI contact optimist had always hoped, have made humanity realise at last how small and weak and limited it was. Not yet, it hadn't. You hadn't gone to war with anybody, despite the planetary instabilities and pressures on various frontiers and resource loads. And behind the scenes you kept working, but your ambassadors pointedly ignored each other at cocktail party receptions. That was politics. Tash was learning. Diplomacy. On the other hand, she knew, those same relatively stable, for now, good diplomatic relations only fed some of the wilder conspiracy theories going around, many of them gleefully relayed to her by Grace Butterworth. Theories such as there was no Galaxius at all, and the blink and all its consequences were the machinations of some international cabal intent on total mind control of the population. And the blink itself was obviously a mass hallucination due to drugs in the water supply and brain viruses transmitted through phones. Sometimes Tash wondered, vaguely, uneasily, if Grace herself was drawn to such ideas, so enthusiastically did she relay them. When Tash had talked this over with Mel, she had said she wished it was some kind of James Bond villain cartel, because it would be a hell of a lot easier to overthrow than the authentic Galaxius. At last, the plane started its final descent. Tash and Mel both checked their phones, hoping for better signals the plane's system had been able to afford them in the air. Mel glanced over. At last. Right. We'll be running. Any more from Noel, by the way? His cataracts, you mean? Another minor fallout from the blink. Intense solar ultraviolet getting through a patchy ozone layer and damaging human eyes. Minor, unless it was you. Nothing new, the usual grumbles. Sometimes I think he's older than his years, you know? Grumbles like what? Well, he says there's hardly any birdsong to be heard. She glanced down at her phone, thumbed through messages. Some bloody spring, he says here, just today. Worse than the climate collapse days. Mel pulled her lip. That's the magnetic field disturbances, maybe. Affecting migrating birds, I'm just guessing. She tapped her own phone, looking stuff up. I don't think anybody knows. There's too much going on. You can't follow it all. You can't even filter it, prioritize it effectively. I wonder if that's a sign that we are close to some kind of collapse. A collective brainstorm. Tash glanced over. Or individual brainstorms. Which was, of course, a reference to the deeper reason why she and Mel had done their best to wangle their way onto this trip. To get to she, who had been buried for long, silent weeks at the heart of Serena Jones's project. For the in-jokes to keep secrets from each other for so long, such big ones anyhow, was pretty much unprecedented. Maybe this was too big to leak, even to friends. Or maybe the evening was drawing in for the in-jokes. Well, one way or another, here they were. The plane made its final descent. The landscape beneath opened up. From the air, Jones's development centre looked like nothing so much as an elderly, disused airport. Mel pointed out landmarks like wind tunnels and scarred runways. This had once been the NASA Ames Research Centre, Tash knew. Latterly, it had become an NHSA facility, still formerly owned by the Rump US, but now standing in American Free States territory. They were somewhere in Northern California, not far from the venerable Stanford University, and close to an old US Navy airbase. These proximities, presumably, being reasons for this facility's location in the first place. Lots of history, of a sort. Tash remained underwhelmed. By the time the plane had cautiously taxied to a halt, close to the shabby, much-repaired building that was hosting the event, apparently it had once been the site's main cafeteria. Tash and Mel were very late indeed. They got out of their seats as soon as they could, grabbed their phones and carry-on luggage. For now, trusting their hold luggage to the gods of automation, and clambered down the stair that had unfolded from the side of the plane. Then, defying stern automated safety admonishments blaring from loudspeakers, they just ran across the tarmac, over a stretch of lawn, through a tangle of trees. 20-year-old carbon-munching trees in every public place. Tash had time to reflect. Even in an old aeronautical centre in the middle of a desiccated California, and made it to the building itself, where she was waiting for them in person. He was propping a door open, alongside a security guard with a Jones Inc. Spaceship and Swoosh logo on his jacket. She said, "Shit, you're late!" But he gave them both buffed kisses on the cheek, as they were security swiped by the guard's wand, and then turned and led them, at a near run, down a corridor towards what looked like the door to a brightly lit auditorium. His exoskeletal support, worn under his clothes, creaked and hummed. "Good to see you too," Mel said dryly, as she struggled to keep up. "Apologies for getting held up by the end of the damn world. She, you're wearing a suit." "I held a couple of seats at the front." The auditorium, when they reached it, was a cavernous box with an oddly greasy, smoky smell, Tash thought. This really had once been a cafeteria then. A crude stage had been set up at the far end of the room, a podium and a row of chairs. Serena Jones was already standing at the podium. Before her, more chairs in neat rows, crowded with suits. A murmur of conversation. Light and camera drones hovered. She hurriedly guided them to the promised pair of empty seats at the front, waved them to sit. Then he turned, leapt up onto the stage, and took his own seat. Mel called, Good exoskeleton work there, Shi. He flashed them a nervous smile. Mel's hand slipped around Tasha's, just for a second, a squeeze. It's still him, she murmured. Tash squeezed back, let go, and Serena made ready. A tap of the microphone on the podium, a push at her old-fashioned spectacles. She began to speak. Okay, she said. Now we're all here, at last. She raised a hand in apology. But Serena, slim, elderly, elegant, in a smart suit, waved him back. No, no, you're the star of the show, Wu Shi. And in a way, this is all your idea. Your inspiration, anyhow. If we can't wait a moment for you to greet your friends. Nothing is stronger than friendship, right? Not the woes of the world. And certainly not the whim of some kind of galactic superpower. If our current interpretation of what's happened to us all over the last 5 months or so is any guide. She faced her audience. Whim. I use the word advisedly. Because when an absolute power reigns absolutely, that's what we are subject to. The whim of the God Emperor Galaxius. Well, we Americans have been fighting off monarchs and other autocrats for nearly 3 centuries so far. A positive-sounding murmur indicated to Tash that Serena was, predictably, hitting the right note. Tash knew that this event was intended for the global press, as well as the space industry investors who Serena wished to draw into collaboration, and the governmental and scientific types of all sorts, including Tash and Mel themselves. It was the launch of a big, ambitious, multinational technological project before an audience that might have been expected to be sceptical. But Tash, in those first moments, sensed nothing but unstated support. Maybe Serena was, fundamentally, right to try this, whatever the detail of the project turned out to be, whether it worked out or not. People needed to hear something positive, to know that somebody was going to do something. That positivity, she knew from Mel, was what had attracted Lee Yamanaka to the project in the first place, on behalf of her president. Which did mean, Tash reflected, the audience might not be as critical as they ought to be. An easy sell for Serena Jones, then, who had made a career out of selling the expensive and outlandish. Now Jones waved her hand. So welcome to this magnificent cafeteria. Good-natured laughter. And welcome to what is now officially the Jones Inc. Charles F. Hall Research Center. Yes, I did it. I bought up NASA Ames. Like buying a piece of the True Cross to any space buff, right? Well, I didn't have to strike a very hard bargain. I think it's fair to say that the glory days of Ames were over long before the unwelcome arrival of Galaxius. But nothing can take away the history of this place and its association with the name of Pioneer. Yes, including Pioneer 10, the first ship to get out of the solar system. And apparently, which had caused all this hoo-ha, for the greatest triumphs of that line of spacecraft were designed and built here. But did you know that the Pioneer name has a history that dates back to the first American ventures into space? Pioneer 1, in fact, was the very first craft controlled by NASA to reach space just a year after Sputnik, though it was launched by the Air Force. And even though it never reached orbit, it did make it into the Van Allen radiation belts, and so delivered some crucial scientific data as well as engineering experience. Well, back in those days, NASA was young and fast-growing, and it took over this place, which had already been a long-standing aeronautics laboratory of some renown. Ames was always one of NASA's smaller centres, but far from the least significant. For inspired by those very early satellite experiments, the Ames directors, ahead of their time, had already made a pitch to design and build a new range of smart but well-engineered and robust craft, basically intended for the first interplanetary missions. So the later pioneers, after those illustrious 1950s predecessors, would be sent to monitor the Sun and to Venus. And most famously of all, Pioneers 10 and 11, which became the first probes to reach the outer planets. Famously, or now, notoriously. Which is why we are here today, right? Because NASA Ames built Pioneer 10. And as my colleague here has convincingly argued, she waved a hand at Xi, it was Pioneer 10's achievement in achieving solar escape velocity in leaving the solar system in December 1973, first in terms of kinetic energy and later in terms of literal distance, that has brought you here today. She opened her arms wide and looked to the sky, or the ceiling anyhow, Tash observed wryly. You. I'm talking about you up there. You, Galaxius. If you can hear me, through that toy you left on the moon. More laughter, if uneasy. Jones spoke on. Yes, you. You realize that fragile robot craft stealing a little momentum from Jupiter, barely able to limp out of the system, was a precursor to what was to follow. And more craft, another pioneer, the Voyagers, others, each one heavier, long-lasting, more sophisticated, did indeed follow. Each of them with some primary target in our solar system, but each too, eventually, pushing that little bit further into the gulf of interstellar space. And never to return. She smiled at the audience. You know, as a kid I myself imagined travelling on some early starship and going out and collecting those fragile old pioneers and bringing them back here to Earth. Hang them from the roof of the Air and Space Museum, right? Well, it looks like the future isn't going to work out that way, doesn't it? Because you up there, Galaxius, didn't like what you saw. And so you sent us the blink, a warning, right? An order to stop right here. The planets may be for us, but not the stars. Not now, not ever. Because you have taken it all. That's what we think is in your mind, anyhow. Well, guess what? We ain't stopping. And that's what today is all about. Let me make clear what we're planning here. We're going to send humans out to where only robots have been before. Yes, humans. A human crew. We're going to build a starship. She stepped back, sipped some water, waited for a reaction, which seemed mixed to Tash. There was some polite applause, almost mandatory in response to lines like that. Some stronger enthusiasm, even a rebel yell from somewhere, but also caution, unease. As well there might be, she thought. Since January, the power of Galaxius had been evident, like it or not. And since Jones had pitched to Yamanaka her idea of sending a human-crewed spacecraft out of the solar system, a basic pitch long since leaked. Nothing had been heard of the detail of how she was going to achieve this. She was going to have to be damn convincing, Tash thought. But here was Serena Jones, stern but frail-looking, defiant. Even as she stood there, the applause swelled again. Mel whispered to Tash. She's the student in front of the tanks in Tiananmen Square. Fragile. Magnificent. She held up her phone. Jane and her pals are loving this. Or she's bluffing. Serena seemed aware of the same doubts. Now she grasped the podium, glared around. A crude starship. Or at least interstellar capable. With people aboard, and we're going to build it, or its components, right here. As you can guess, it ain't going to be cheap. Nothing in space ever is. This will be another Project Apollo, though shorter, sharper, perhaps more clearly focused. And it could well consume as high a percentage of the nation's GDP as Apollo in its heyday. Which is a sign of the backing President Cox and the US administration are giving this thing. As well as our hosts, the American Free States. She gestured to the back of the room. And all this is thanks to our key political and corporate allies. A rumble of noise, people twisting in their seats. Among a sea of heads, Tash thought she recognised the colourful bulk of Lee Yamanaka, the president's science advisor, grinning broadly. Mel whispered, "We've come a long way since she and I took the pioneer thing to Lee in Alaska." Tash patted her hand. You changed the world. And the specific reason you are all here, Jones went on, is that we are launching today a request for proposals from potential subcontractors. I have to tell you that there was no competitive bidding when we got the contract. A bid we made through NHSA but backed by the American federal government. We got a sole source contract. Not really the done thing, but, well, we were the sole source of the idea. But we can't build this alone, clearly. Aside from the propulsion and power, I'll talk about that. There's a whole slew of subsystems that need innovative thinking, comms, data management, radiation proofing, life support. Because nobody has done this before, no human. Nobody has flown so far, so fast, for so long. We're going to have to figure out how to do it all. We will build on proven systems where possible. But that ain't always going to be possible. Because there are no proven precursors. So we invite tenders. We are also, of course, issuing announcements of opportunities to the science community. This is a vessel of exploration of science, after all. And as to how we are going to build this... Jones raised her arms, looking almost messianic, Tash thought. Well, in management terms, we are going to do it the way they built Pioneer 10, that's how. And that's why you are sitting in what will now be known as the Charles F. Hall Center. Charles Hall, who spent his entire career at NASA Ames, was project manager for the Interplanetary Pioneers, and it was he who discovered the Ames Center's greatest successes. So what more suitable name could we give the old place now? And when Hall took over, one of the first decisions he made was to commandeer this big old cafeteria as an office space. So here we are again. Ripple of laughter. Hall has always been one of my personal studies in how to run complex. Indeed, cutting-edge, technical projects successfully. She emphasised her points with fist pumps. You bring talented people together. You encourage them to express themselves. You brainstorm solutions to problems. You hold your meetings standing up. So after a couple of hours, everybody gets uncomfortable. And that's one sure motivation to wrap things up fast. When the project is underway, you keep things simple. You break it down into achievable stages. You use stuff that's worked before. When you have a working design, you freeze it. Rigid change control. You modify only if you really have to. And you deliver fast. We can deliver fast. I can announce now that we're planning to do our main testing and build out at the Lodestone in Earth's Umbra. Jones Inc. has always part-funded that facility in order to be able to use it as a zero-gravity skunk works. We can build fast. I'm announcing now that we will aim for a conclusion of Stage 1, a test flight of the propulsion system by the end of the year. Ideally earlier, she grinned, wolfish. Maybe you can tell I'm looking forward to this. That's how we will build this. But what I haven't told you yet is what we are going to build. Well, when you are going somewhere new, further than anyone has gone before, you need a new technology. Like this. She raised one hand, snapped her fingers, and a hologram image appeared in the air over the stage. Everyone turned to look up, including she, Tash noticed. She wondered, not for the first time, how much he knew in detail about what he was getting into. The ship was mostly a wide, barely concave dish. A dish or a sail, Tash thought. Made of some wispy material, so that background stars were visible through it, and it was spinning slowly. At its centre was a short, boxy, rectangular hull. The whole thing looked like an immense umbrella, blown inside out. Somebody yelled out from the audience, "That's some kind of ram scoop!" "You could call it that," Jones said. "I should say, this depiction, meant for clarity, isn't to scale." She snapped her fingers again. The dish grew wider and flatter. The handle of the umbrella shrank to a speck by comparison. Yes, it is a ram scoop. The scoop itself is made of graphene. the lowest density substance we could find. In fact, a netting. So the surface density is even lower than that. The main hull is assembled from standard Jones shelter modules, each 12 meters long. And how big is that darn dish? Oh, about the diameter of planet Mercury. That interrogator seemed to splutter. Are you crazy? No, that's how big it needs to be. To do what? What the hell are you going to scoop up? Not interstellar dust or hydrogen. Something more fundamental than that. Madam, this is a dark energy drive. Jones let them take that in. Tash had no idea what it meant. Mel evidently knew enough to be stunned to silence. So did much of the audience, it sounded like. A scatter of uncomfortable laughter. Okay, Jones went on. Conceptual shock time. But look, the engineers among you will know what the benefits of a ram scoop are. Any ram scoop. You don't need to carry any propellant. You just sail through the medium of choice, sucking stuff in and using it for its energy, as a jet engine takes in oxygen from the air. There have been studies over decades, maybe a century, of ramjet starships taking in the interstellar medium, as you suggested, madam, which is largely hydrogen, the cooled-down wind from the stars. Maybe you could collect it up and use it as fusion fuel, as in the heart of the sun. But the practical details turned out to be intractable. Dark energy, though. Dark energy is a kind of energy field that pervades the whole universe, from the scale of this room up to the largest superclusters of galaxies. And it is a kind of expansion field, relentlessly pushing the whole universe apart. Do you know what this stuff is? Well, I don't either. But since the blink, we have been playing around with it in our Lodestone Skunk Works, along with other advanced technologies, and we think we know ways to trap it. But all we really care about is that it is energy. Almost vanishingly sparse, which is why my damn scoop is so big. But it is everywhere. And if we could tap it, we could go anywhere. And indeed return, as a bonus. As I said, I believe we, Jones Inc., can tap dark energy. And that is how we are going to send a crewed ship out of the solar system. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in an ocean of soup. And we of Jones Inc. may just have invented the spoon. That provoked a tension-busting laugh. Okay, Jones said. So that's the proposed system. Information packs are being downloaded to you now. But let's get back to the purpose of the technology, the mission itself, which is, of course, a mission to break out of the solar system. That was met by a stunned silence for a few heartbeats, and then some scattered applause. Another rebel yell, too, murmured conversations. Jones spoke on steadily. Yep, I hear your reaction. Now, I listen to the debates. I know that many of you will think this is just an appalling idea, to do what Pioneer 10 did before, to do the one thing we believe Galaxius doesn't want us to do. Why it wants that, we can only speculate. But Galaxius musters overwhelming force. It can impose its will, you may say. So what's the point in defying it? I can give you several answers. One is, what if we are simply wrong? What if we are somehow misreading the meaning of the blink, the motivation of Galaxius, even its nature? That it is some kind of galaxy-spanning organism, or even a single entity. Let's test our understanding. Let's see what's really out there. A godlike interstellar beast, or just a fleet of beat-up Klingon birds of prey, cloaked so we can't see them, crewed by folks not much smarter than we are, or less. And let's see if it really does intend to stop us breaking out of the solar system. Let's see if it can. Nobody knows. And we can't base our whole future as a species on guesswork. Let's go out there and see if it stops us. Or test whether it can stop us. I mean, can it? Fooling around with the sun is one thing. What if it can't stop us as individuals, at the level of a single ship? Just as you can stomp an ant's nest, but can't necessarily kill every damn ant in the process. A rueful grin. I grant that's not a very reassuring metaphor, but we ain't going to know unless we go find out, are we? Isn't that what science is for? Look, we are proposing a test of the hypothesis that we now live in a cage. Whether we break out or not, we will know where we are. Better than we know it now. She glanced at her phone. Okay, that's enough from me, almost. Two more things to tell you. The first is the name of the ship. She grinned and waved a hand at the gauzy model beside her. Given all I've said, maybe you can guess at that. Pioneers 10 and 11 went to Jupiter and beyond, and are now sailing out of the solar system. Pioneers 12 and 13 went to Venus. And so I give you Pioneer 14. That drew applause, slow at first. Thank you, thank you. Well, we have a ship, and we have yet to name the crew. But I can announce the mission commander. People started standing up, more enthusiastic applause. You're ahead of me. It was Wu Ji here who figured out the Pioneer 10 Galaxias timeline in the first place, and it was Xi's presence at my side that convinced President Cox to buy this program in the first place. Whooping and cheering. Here he is. Here he is. The next Neil Armstrong, if you will. She called out his name again, but the applause drowned out her voice. Xi got out of his chair, solemn-faced, arms raised, facing the camera drones and raised phones all around him. Mel had to yell in Tasha's ear. That's not our Xi. He'd have been terrified. Self-conscious, both. But he looks determined, Tash yelled back, feeling as dismayed as Mel sounded. Or obsessed. They really are going to do this, aren't they? He is going to do it. We came all this way to see him. But we've lost him, Tash. Right here. Right now. Mel grasped her hand. Let's hope you're wrong. The discipline of the audience broke down, and people rushed the stage, surrounding Xi and Jones. Overhead drones bathed them both in an almost heavenly light. Still holding hands, Mel and Tash retreated to the back of the room, out of the old cafeteria, and found their way outside into the muggy Californian air.